Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, and my co-host, Felicity Signal-Reed. Each week at this time, we visit with a local author and get a glimpse into their lives. Perhaps we ask them what prompts them to write, and we get an opportunity to hear them read from their work. Today, we're very pleased to welcome Deborah Panko. Deborah is a well-known poet who lives in Coburg. Her poetry has been published in many anthologies, including Not a Muse, which contains poems by women from all around the world, and another anthology, From O to Snow, a collaboration with two other poets, Kate Marshall Flaherty and Donna Lajavan. This was published by Hidden Book Press in 2010. Deborah's first collection of her own poetry, Somewhat Elsewhere, was also published by Hidden Book Press in 2008. Deborah was born in Thorold in Ontario and moved to Toronto when she went to university. After working as a waitress, a crematorium receptionist, and a registered massage therapist, among other things, in those student years, she taught ESL in Algeria and on returning to Canada took up a teaching career with the Toronto School Board. It was after taking early retirement in 2004 that she moved to Coburg, where she has continued to write and publish her poetry. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello.
You said that poetry is a natural instinct for me, like trying to read a person's face. Could you elaborate on this comment a little bit?
Poetry started with me with my parents. It's not quite what you think. It's not that they wrote poetry. My father was mostly deaf, and it was a challenge to communicate with him. I dedicated, actually, my most recent poetry book, it's called Blueprint by Cro-Magnon Publishing, to him. And his name is Nick, and I think if I read this poem, it would be kind of self-explanatory. I should mention that in 1910, Nick's parents emigrated from the Ukraine to Canada. And Baba means grandmother. At a year old, my father was taken from the farm in Manitoba into North Dakota. My Baba pressed to find the nearest priest who would both baptize and give Nick last rites. Such an event in his history, more crucial, more marked than his birth, my father always suspected the esteemed baptismal certificate somehow made him an American. Typhoid fever had inflamed Nick's mastoid bones, those tiny breast-shaped projections behind each inner ear. When the fever left, so had his hearing, except for that 10%, that fragile link in one ear, allowing him a few words to fit the movements of a mouth, settling him somewhat into the drift. He couldn't hear Beethoven or birdsong, nodded yes so as not to appear ungrateful or difficult or bring unwanted attention to himself. Drank too many coffees each day, bought for him by seamen at the dock, where for 35 years he drove a forklift, loading one-ton rolls of paper onto boats at the Wellenship Canal. He would have made a better carpenter, measuring, calculating, working wood into what could be useful, stackable bookshelves for his daughters, a cradle, a rocking horse for his granddaughter. But the apprenticeship had gone to the owner's son. Dad's promotion to factory foreman, a schizophrenic wife often in the hospital, two children left alone during shift work, and the ulcers that he kept in check with cottage cheese and milk lunch biscuits burst. His one visit to the hospital during all the time I'd known him until his heart attack at 84. He's 98 now, a frail dragon, fiery in his opinions but compassionate, generous, easy to like, his story as familiar to me as my own. A story that might account for this strange disposition of mine, a fear there are too few words to come my way, too few words to ease my doubts, make sense of the impossible. A story that might explain my hours at the piano figuring out the fingering of a B-flat minor 7 that will slide effortlessly into an E-flat minor, something Nick will never hear played. Or how I taught English my entire working life, connecting to the few who cared, or learned the names, craved the calls of every bird I traveled to see, always knowing somewhere Nick was listening, even when he didn't answer back.
That's wonderful.
There's a second part to this, actually, and that has to do with my mother, who is schizophrenic. And I think I'm probably genetically disposed to writing poetry. She read the dictionary obsessively and read somewhere a while back that this is a common behavior of schizophrenics. So I think my obsession with words came from there as well. I tend to take a word and deconstruct it. So if you like, I can read a couple of poems more. One is to my mother.
That would be lovely,
Helen.
Thank you.
And my mother died at 83, and someone had said to me, you know, poems don't have to mean anything. And I thought, sure they do. So this is for my mother. 1923 to 2007. Helen, if poems aren't meant to be about anything, just words about really nothing at all, then I wonder why I am bothered to share this, to describe my mother's dying, her death still fresh in my mind from that Monday when I was away in Costa Rica. When, for 2 days, I had been protesting to Ron, why do I have so many bug bites? 83 volcanic red bumps, a crater in the center of each. I laughed out loud in the shower on Wednesday morning before her burial when it came to me. She sent me fleas. One flea for each year of her life to get my attention. To say you are a measure of my living, you have taken part in my misery, you will be here with me in time to say goodbye. She always knew how to get under my skin. It's how she loved me. It's why I write poetry.
Oh. That hits me right in the heart.
It does. And then I guess just to give you a sense of how I immerse myself in a word, it's kind of like deconstructing a word, I thought I would read desire. It's how kind of a one word can become a whole world. Desire. Treat her as an abstract with drooping shoulders, a practiced form yet out of reach. Feign divine indifference as if nothing in particular matters, and still you will wake each morning to what wants to be there, knowing she's everywhere and everything matters. The ancients say she is God's idea, falling like Lucifer from the stars, a place of danger to and through where even the thought of her lies. But when she is breath, pulled from out there to where you are, sentient, tangible, you take her at her word.
So there's a sort of the background on an emotional level, but what about form? How do you decide on what form a particular poem is going to take? And how important is form to you?
Form is probably all of it. I'm not sure you can separate the form from the content. They go hand in hand. I usually start with a fragment and something that just comes to me, and it will either fall into a predetermined form or it takes on a life of its own and starts to dictate the form. I have a couple of poems, let me see, that can kind of illustrate that. One is kind of in response to Emily Dickinson, the American 19th century poet. So this one, I can't remember quite where I started, but it ended up being rhyming couplets. It's called Yes, and it's in response to Wild Nights by Emily Dickinson. Dear Emily advises, in a paradox of surprises, that for passion to be felt, one can only melt into the unknown, the unmeasured, or into another who is treasured. For to be unbound in nightly dreams is to be found by life, it seems. Another little example is I love writing haikus. That's the three-line short little poems, five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables, and this is called Summer. It has the demigod Pan in it, who is kind of half man, half goat, and he plays the flute, and it's kind of an extension of a what?
Life,
absolutely. He's vegetation, right? This is called Summer. Honeysuckle blush. Pan prowling fields on all fours, dragonflies orbed eyes. But I'll read one more around this, around the form. This one is kind of about me, I suppose, but it's how you start somewhere and then it kind of takes on a life of its own.
Oh, okay.
And the form sort of takes on a life of its own. Called Cowbird, and it's about, you know, the blackbird with a brown head?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you might see him at your feeder. Cowbird, that part of me I dislike, that my conscience doesn't accept, says you have no right to be here making your home here, a prairie dweller who should be riding the backs of buffalo, not laying your eggs in another's nest, leaving parenting to the more industrious ones. Your oversized offspring eating what is meant for the legitimate. You thrive on space, but here you displace the ones who belong. I turned the garden hose on you, pummeling you with my gushing emotions like I did that squirrel once, running atop a telephone wire, but only after he dared me, standing on his haunches, asserting it was his backyard, not mine. I showed him the punishing waters chasing him all the way to the road. But not you. Your alien black eye, rapid wing beats like buckshot, spraying tank top shorts, you pull me back into my own darkness like the black dog of depression, its head dipped in mud brown, cowl of adaptability, howl of aggression. Your cowbird creaks and bubbles, chucks and glugs, wrapped in a feathered crown, taken up residence before I even knew it hit me.
Wow.
Yeah, they're prairie birds. But just in terms of form, what you were saying is you have to hang on to something. There has to be a gravitational pull. And in that poem, what happened was the ow sounds, you know, they just
howl.
You hear them, yeah. So something like that in a poem will hold it together. It'll be either the sounds or line breaks, the visual look of a poem. But for me, there has to be something that makes it something.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now we need to take a short break.